You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
It's 5 o'clock on Friday afternoon. My name's Jacob.
Well, I must be Mercedes then. And we're on Community Radio 3CR with Friday Rave.
Yes, you are indeed listening to a Friday Rave this 23rd of the 1st on Community Radio 3CR at 8:55 a.m. or 3CR Digital or online at all the W's at 3cr.org.au. And, of course, through the Preston ceiling fan or wherever it may be at this moment.
The depressed ceiling fan. Yeah, look, I'm going to get right into it today because we've both got a lot to say, I'm sure.
As always.
I don't call it a Friday Rave for nothing. Now, but to start with, we really can't avoid talking today about the new Combating Anti-Semitism, Hate and Extremism Criminal and Migration Laws Bill that was rubber-stamped in Canberra on Tuesday. Now, it won't come as a surprise to any 3CR listeners, let alone Friday Rave listeners, that we think this law is an absolute crock of shit. Can't put it any plainer than that.
Yeah.
Now, I've spent hours I'll never get back, reading through the legislation and the other laws it amends and the state laws it references. And normally I'd urge you to do the same. I mean, how many times have we said on this show, go read the legislation yourselves? But in this case, I'm not saying that. Not because it's not important, but because it'll do your bloody head in. It's crazy. Anyway, here on a Friday Rave, we try to bring information that you wouldn't come across in too many other places. And there is some reasonable analysis in various places online, and we urge you to use just a small part of your time you'll save by not reading the legislation to have a look at some of it. And I'd recommend places like The Conversation, Michael West Media, Pearls and Irritations, all have some bits of it. Not as good as you'll get here, of course, but hey. In short, the new law gives the government the power to ban organisations and imprison individuals for up to 15 years for doing and saying things that can make a reasonable person feel fear based on their ethnic, national or religious identity. Now, nominally, as it's actually in the name, it's about combating anti-Semitism. But again, you know, what can I say? You don't need us to tell you that the term anti-Semitism today doesn't actually refer to a bigotry against people. All it say is it limited to bigotry against people of Semitic origin, but about silencing criticism of the state of Israel.
As determined by the IRA definition of which this legislation takes its definition from.
Yeah, and you know, we've mentioned Project Esther numerous times, and this is part of it. But that's the first big problem with this legislation. If we take it at face value, just for a moment, suspend our cynicism and disbelief and accept that this isn't just about Israel, but actually about protecting people, a particular group that, yes, has suffered hatred and oppression based on their ethnicity and or faith, along, I've got to say at this point, with others in our community. I mean, do we need to remind you of the violent African youth gangs mania or the Yellow Peril, not to mention it's Invasion Day on Monday, or that, you know, groups may be singled out or targeted for criteria or other than ethnicity or faith? But this, what this law's done, it's shown that one group has not only had a special law enacted to protect their feelings, because this is about feeling, about people feeling fear. No actual crime, such as we understood the word last week, needs to have been committed or taken place. That's about one group, ostensibly, though we know it's not. Well, in effect, that writes into Australian law that there are different levels of crime depending on the identity of the victim. And that's important. We don't have that. I mean, there are special provisions in various places for Indigenous Australians, but that's for obvious reasons.
Yeah, First Nations folks. And I guess it's now written into law. There are various anti-discrimination legislations that, you know, take it on value across the spectrum.
Yeah. But, look, I understand that even this, even saying that, even pointing that out, might be construed by at least what the government considered to be a reasonable person as hate speech, quote unquote. So we need to point out, we want to point out, but we need to point out that we abhor racism and bigotry in all its forms and are saddened and outraged by the terrorist attack at Bondi last month, as anybody else, probably even more than most. But emotions and outrage should not be the driving force to recall Parliament and rush through new and sweeping and unprecedented laws that undermine what we have come to understand until recently as fundamental rights.
And also to collapse them all into one single piece of legislation across the vast, like across different previous legislation like gun laws and migration, and like collapsing them all into one bill, as we spoke about last week.
Yeah, exactly. You know, but, you know, maybe they weren't actually the driving force. You know, I'm not suggesting there was some kind of conspiracy to use last month's shooting as an excuse to introduce these laws. And I can already hear some of the cookers saying some quite outrageous things. But I'm just saying maybe it was seized upon as an opportunity to further the trajectory towards a security state that was not available on December the 10th. Anyway, that was Human Rights Day, by the way, December the 10th, the day before the shooting. Remember Human Rights Day?
Mm.
Yeah, it sounds quaint now, like National Librarians Day or something. But anyway,
it's kind of fallen to the wayside, hasn't it?
Well, exactly. I said there's plenty of commentary on what these new laws will make illegal and who they'll be used again. Although you just need to look at David Spears' train wreck interview with the Attorney General Michelle Rowland on the ABC's that was 7:30 report?
7:30 report, yeah. It's from, it was on Tuesday night.
Tuesday, which must have reminded him of the time he interviewed a former Attorney General, George Brandis. Remember that one? That was David Spear as well. I interviewed him on metadata during Spears' previous gig at Sky News about, 2014.
And urging listeners just to jump on YouTube and look that up, because the similarities or the comparison is almost uncanny, really.
It is, not least of which is David Spears doesn't seem to have aged a day. But anyway, but that's the second problem with this law. It's so damn vague, you know, because Penny Wong or Michelle Rowland couldn't actually answer how the laws will be used.
Mm.
You know, it's just so vague, it could mean anything you want it to. Well, not what you want it to, but what they want it to.
But that was interesting, because in that interview with Michelle Rowland, she was like, it needs to be able to be interpreted by the Home Affairs Minister, and said the Attorney General also has something to say on it, and also by intelligence agencies. But if it can't even be interpreted by the Attorney General on the day that it passes through the legislation, what does that interpretation look like in the future?
Well, I mean, one would imagine, I don't know anything about Michelle Rowland's background, but as AG, I imagine she's at least got a basic arts law degree, you know. And crikey, she could have, but then George Brandis didn't know what metadata was. So I suppose it's same.
Tony Abbott wasn't a tech head.
No. And Malcolm Turnbull basically invented the internet. But anyway. So while, you know, allegedly, I dare say, left-wing commentators are questioning who will be targeted because it's called a combat anti-Semitism law, while that is problematic enough, the vagueness of it ensures it can be used in relation to any national, ethnic or religious group.
Mm.
And not to mention having to decide what legally defines words like hate or fear or safety or symbols. Now, I obviously don't want a society where swastikas are on display and people are walking around giving Nazi salutes to each other. But you know what? Neither do I want a society where displaying a swastika as part of a political comment about fascism can be seen as use of a hate symbol.
Yeah, and this is about, context, but also in terms of banning symbols. Now, you can say one thing, but lots of experts on anti-fascism and say that the banning of symbols alone as taken as the spearhead of any legislation of how to deal with neo-Nazis or anti-Semitism or any of these things. The banning of symbols alone does not get rid of the root of the ideology.
That's right. Banning doesn't work. They could spend billions of dollars on banning swastikas, for example, and in 50 years, swastikas may be as scarce on our streets as heroin.
Mm.
Banning doesn't work. But there's another problem, many problems. A third big problem is that there's absolutely no procedural fairness. Now, this means that any organisation banned has no avenue for defence or appeal, no right of reply, nothing. You're now a banned organisation. That's it. You can't even respond in the media or in the socials, let alone 3CR, because the very fact of responding will be deemed to be a crime. Because if they say, you know, we're going to ban, let's say, renegade activists under this, we can't even represent renegade activists because we'd be banned and we'd be seen as representing a banned organisation. So there's no procedural fairness. You know, mass murderers, child rapists, even George Bloody Pell, for Christ's sake, gets his day in court, as they should. But not anyone charged under this new law. And while the likes of Roland and Wong are citing the fascists and Islamic terrorists as targets, to my mind at least, invoking the famous quote attributed to, I think it's Voltaire, even those we disagree with should have the right to defend themselves and their position. Now, another problem, I think, what are we up to? The fourth problem I have is this law's retrospectivity. Words and actions spoken and made before this law came into effect can be used as evidence to prosecute a ban. Now, fair enough. It could be argued that any reasonable person should not need a law to know that some things should never have been spoken publicly in polite society. And they should be held accountable for their words and actions. But accountability for being a racist dickhead needs to happen in the public arena, not in a star chamber. And this is not just about public. I mean, I'm not a right-wing fascist arsehole, but if I were, then, and I think you're going to talk something about this soon, they'll have access to my private messages with other right-wing arseholes, and even stuff there that's in private messaging can be constituted as hate speech and rah-rah-rah-rah-rah-rah-rah-rah-rah.
Yep.
Now, I'm not supporting these people's position by any means, but today it's about Nazis, tomorrow it might be about us.
Well, yeah, and we've spoken about that before, and I guess in terms of, I will talk about this, but just on that, what you were saying of having access not only to what's in messages or emails or anything like that, or by a carriage service, but also making the map of distinction of associations. And so
exactly.
Actually, where does it stop in terms of association?
Yeah, and this is what David Spears was interviewing George Brandis about in 2014 about metadata. But there are more problems. That was the fourth. The fifth problem is a dual one, and that it both reverses the burden of proof, meaning the government doesn't need to prove anything. The accused needs to prove the negative. Now, this basic reversal of the need to prove a crime has been used before in so-called anti-terror provisions, and it's coupled, you know, with a whole lot of other anti-terrorist provisions. Australia brought in more laws, you know, about anti-terror than any other country in the world. So it goes with all that. But then the other thing it shows is that ignorance is no excuse. You can't say, I didn't know this was banned, or I didn't know this is what it meant. You know, I mean, there are words coming into the common lexicon every day. Well, not every day, there's an exaggeration. Every year that an old bloke like me sometimes takes 3 or 4 years to find out what they mean, you know.
Well, ignorance is no excuse, but if you don't know what that is, but then you've got no right of reply, then, you know.
Yeah. Well, and the symbols, I mean, anyway. And what do we mean by symbols anyway? It's like, I remember years ago I used to put up stickers on rubbish bins around Sydney with a picture of a stick figure dropping a swastika in the garbage bins. People have seen them around town. Still, people who are to this day. You're sticking a swastika. And that is now a banned symbol. So we can't use a swastika, not just in terms of saluting it, but in terms of using it to denigrate a fascist position. Can't use that anymore. Finally, I want to say, whatever number I'm up to. I'll say this is finally. But by finally, I mean the final issue I raised today. Oh, excuse me. Is who's going to be making that decision? Now, strictly by the legislation, it'll be the Home Affairs Minister or any future minister responsible for the Australian Federal Police, taking the thing to the Governor-General, who then prescribes the organisation, after the minister has had consensus from the opposition. Now, this is no doubt inserted to ensure that only the right type or wrong type of organisation gets passed up the chain, ensuring, for example, that the Liberal Party could veto, or even the Labor Party could veto, I don't know, say the Australian Zionist Federation, or One Nation, you know, them being banned or prescribed. But, and here's my big but, sorry, it's the minister in the current setup, the Honourable Burke, needs to take advice from the Director General of Security, currently Mike Burgess, head of ASIO. And surely you can see that not acting on the advice of Burgess in agreeing to list an organisation would require greater fortitude than any minister or shadow minister in Parliament right now has so far displayed. Can you imagine Mike Burgess? And, you know, he's a bit of a media tart. He gets front of the camera every opportunity he gets, saying, I want to prescribe this organisation, and the Minister of Home Affairs saying, no, you're wrong, mate.
You're wrong.
Goodbye, Minister for Home Affairs.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, we did make the prediction just a few weeks ago, I think the week of the Bondi massacre, shooting, terrorist attack, whatever you want to call it. We made the prediction on this show that far from being castigated for his organisation's abject failure in doing anything to stop the ACRIM's killing spree, Burgess and ASIO would be rewarded with additional powers. And that's exactly what's happened. Mike Burgess, you know, it's up to him and his successors.
And Chrissy Barrett as well.
And Chrissy Barrett in the AFP.
Yeah, that's right.
Yep. And who is this bloke? You know, Mike Burgess, say he's a media tart, but while officially tasked to mitigate risks to Australian society, Burgess has a consistent record of promulgating the narrative of the US-led Five Eyes network, of which Australia is obviously a part. You know, years ago, spooks in Australia worked in the shadows. And that's not just because that's where they work best, but because the very core, the very premise of the work they do, spying on fellow citizens and lagging on them, was anathema to the moral code of Australian society.
Yeah, what's the? It's like the old adage, snitches get stitches, you know?
Snitches get stitches, and so they should.
Yeah, and so what happened to that now?
Well, you know, nowadays, the role of Australia's spook seems to be celebrated. Look at the ASIO's website. Look at, you know, you've got the head of the ASD fronting the media now. You've got the head of intelligence networks fronting the media, becoming, you know, celebrities in their own right. In spite of their monumental fuck-ups. Or maybe because of them. That's a question for another day. But anyway, there are other things we need to talk about today. But we wanted to make the point that the big issue with this legislation is not just the mechanics of how and who and what. And we on the left are going to be good at arguing with each other about how and who and what means. But the laws, the real issue, is in laws being implemented that have none of the checks and balances that up until very recently we would have seen as axiomatic in a reasonable society. And I guess we're rapidly moving to the point where we can no longer call ourselves that.
Now, just on that, I want to go back to Michelle Rowland's interview. On 7:30. And alongside not being able to answer what would be considered hate speech or what actions would constitute designation as a hate group, she deferred to the determination not only resting with the Home Affairs Minister, as you said, but really specifically with ASIO and the AFP. And this was again backed up by Penny Wong. And so the inquiry into the abject failure of the aforementioned intelligence agencies in regards to Bondi has really fallen to the wayside in lieu of since the announcement of the Royal Commission. Mm. Now, we spoke about this the week of Bondi on a Friday rave of Dennis Richardson's
Richardson Review.
The inquiry and of the failures and the terms of reference. And I just want to come back to a couple of those terms of reference in particular. And so in that, this is from the press release. So this is a quote: whether they have adequate legislative powers, the right systems, processes and procedures, and the appropriate authorising environment for information sharing with other federal and state and territory agencies, and whether warrant and data access regimes and powers are adequate. So they're the terms of reference. The implicit suggestion in the terms of reference is that intelligence sharing between departments was not adequate, and in order to gain a full picture of the risk posed by the shooters, even though ASIO already had one of them on a watch list and they deemed him to be all good. So we're certainly not suggesting that ASIO needs more powers to be able to address their shortcomings. They're already given $750 million and layers upon layers of counterterrorism and metadata retention legislations that they shouldn't need the extra powers.
Exactly.
They already exist. And as you said, bearing in mind, after 9/11, Australia passed more counterterrorism legislation than any other country in the world.
Mm.
And so, however, they will argue that undoubtedly the inquiry, even though we'll probably never see it, will determine what more powers is exactly what they'll need.
Exactly. More power.
But the access to the data and the intelligence is not solely the issue here. The issue is that they are suggesting is that the ability to analyse and draw inferences from siloed data sets across federal, state and territory intelligence networks falls short.
Mm.
And folks, there's one company that specialises in this very problem, and one that you might have read this week or heard last month on a Friday rave, that has recently been granted IRAP protected status to work at the high level of government departments. Mm. And we come back once again to Palantir. And Jake, I do sound like a broken record talking about Palantir, but
welcome to my world.
But they are no, but I think it speaks to the pervasiveness. And even though I guess on this continent, their infiltration is still in its pretty fledgling stages, although it's already embedded in the Australian Army with Coles, Hertz, and Westrac.
Mm.
And so, well, for this part, when don't want to get into analysing the parallels between the knee-jerk government response to September 11 and Bondi. Which we may do at some point.
I hope you get the opportunity.
Yeah, but noting here that in the aftermath of the US invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq, Palantir emerged on the scene in 2004 with specific business model of not owning or storing data, but embedding what they called four deployed engineers into the operation centres of departments and specialising their Foundry or Gotham AI platforms to the specific needs of the security or intelligence service. So what this specialisation looks like is the ability to comb through all available databases, identify related pieces of information, and puts everything together in one place to extract whatever information suits the narrative that they're pushing.
Yes.
So, for example, once embedded in use, Palantir's software allows a user to conduct, say, a name search, that might be a date of birth, an email, and they will have a full dossier of information on a citizen, extracting information from web cameras, security cameras at shops, credit card transactions, emails, phone calls, web searches, social media clicks, travel, doctor's appointment, and so it goes.
Oh, everything. And they tried to do this back in the late 80s too with a program called PROMIS, the Prosecutor's Management Information Service, which was stolen from a tech company called InsLaw, I think.
Yeah, right.
And renegade activists doing some work on that back then.
In the 80s.
In the 80s, yeah. But this is what their program is. It's to use data to suck up data.
And so Palantir goes a step further in just kind of scraping all of that data to generate a narrative. But it maps in real time and also embeds AI platforms embedded with predictive analysis to suggest outcomes or determine action. So there's countless evidence of the use of the IDF's AI targeting and the genocide in Gaza with the help of Palantir.
Yep.
We spoke about their Maven program being now in the GHF and now in the command center.
Yep.
And they're
going to form the basis of Trump's new security architecture of the new Gaza.
That's right. And So it's worth mentioning that the same person behind Palantir, which is Peter Thiel, is also behind Polymarket, which we spoke about on last week's Saturday Kick-Ons, which is a shameless plug to give it a listen.
Yep.
And I think it's also worth mentioning that the first venture firm to invest in Palantir back in 2004 was the CIA's InQtel. And so the legislative environment, in order for Palantir to operate, the legislative environment must be ripe for their technology. So as such, breaking down the barriers between the agencies and private companies and their respective data sets is a prerequisite for Palantir's dragnet approach. Yes. So Australia's metadata retention laws make their work easier, as does their global reach in working with every US intelligence agency and department, and with the Five Eyes and Pine Gap, with the Israeli government, military and Mossad. And so the information intelligence sharing is not just domestic, it's international.
Of course it is.
And so I want to wind back for a second in just the couple of minutes that we've got left and think about what their business model is and to thinking about these four deployed engineers.
Yeah.
So in November last year, Palantir were given IRAP protected status, as we said, to work in the highest level of government departments. And although no contracts since the approval have come to light yet that we know of.
And that's come to light.
That is not commercial in confidence or on the basis of national security grounds. So, you know, their model will mean that Palantir engineers will be embedded into these departments to write the software specifically for these government departments.
Yeah.
Now, everything about the previous and pre-existing legislation and the new legislation that's just been rubber stamped this week suggests that Palantir will be the first choice for the Australian government and the intelligence community where it isn't already in use.
Yeah. I mean, the extension of that is not only will they be writing their things to suit the Australian government, as they get entrenched, the Australian government will be seeking creating their forms and the information off their service users in order to fulfil the requirements of Palantir.
Yes, absolutely. And so it'll be kind of like this part subcontracted.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, and I guess where, I mean, I'm just in the next minute or so, the technology is not only going to be able to be used in regards to human terrain mapping, in regards to hate groups as part of this legislation, but it really also pertains to the amendments to the migration legislation and visas.
Absolutely.
And so it's well known that Palantir is designing software for ICE in the US, but a recent report from 404 Media exposed that Palantir is working on a specific tool for ICE that, and this is a quote, populates a map with potential deportation targets, brings up a dossier on each person, and provides a confidence score on the person's current address using, and it's using this technology to find locations of potential detainees, of which in the last year alone there's been almost 67,000. So in this tool, the tool that Palantir is designing in parts takes addresses from the Department of Health and Human Services. And so this is taking across all government departments in a dragnet way,
yep.
Alongside other sources to create the dossier. And I guess in regards to that, what's to suggest that under the guise of this legislation, the same tool won't be utilised here? Palantir's philosophy coming from Lord of the Rings.
The all-seeing eye.
Yeah, and the seeing stones. And the Alex Karp, they're all pretty out forward projecting that they say they're protecting the Shire, or what they really mean is protecting the West. And there's no secret about that Palantir's philosophy.
Well, Palantir was the stone of the men of the West.
Mm. And so that's exactly what their philosophy is. And so with that, alongside Australia's existing indefinite detention infrastructure, it only needs the legislative go-ahead to go open slather on this continent. And it's coming, folks.
Mm.
It's coming. That's about all we've got time for.
Jeez, it's that time already. Neither of us are clock watchers. See you on Monday.
See you on Monday. That's right. It's 11 o'clock at Parliament House on Monday for the Invasion Day rally. There's going to be a panel discussion the night before on Sunday up at Camp Sov, and there's going to be some dinner. There's also a working bee up at Camp Sov during the day on Sunday, and of course the dawn service on Monday morning at 5 a.m. at Camp Sovereignty. But we'll see you there sometime. That's enough from us this week. Stay tuned.
Come up to the stage and say hello.
Stay tuned.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.